I look at the fundamentals and all the reasons why I said that this year I thought would be the year for gold. Like last year, my highest conviction trade was uranium. This year it's gold. And all those reasons are just now beginning to play out. Lobo, how are you?
Well, I am doing well. The world, maybe not so much, but here I am in tropical paradise, hopefully out of harm's way, shaking my head and seeing if, you know, how can I navigate this world best for myself, my family, my readers, my clients, anybody I can help.
Yeah, well said. I would agree with you on that. And this conflict, again, it seems to be escalating. It's just another, and I don't say this, I say this with all due respect, it's another curveball that we have to navigate, I guess, as far as safety as well as just investing. And who knows what's going to happen. So,
if I can just say, I think for our purposes, one, there's the human tragedy. We can take a whole show talking about that. We can't do anything about it. So, and this is a financial oriented show, and that's what we talk about. So if we talk about investment implications, it doesn't mean we're heartless profiteers, just, you know, making blood money here. My finger is not on the button of any of these missiles falling or tanks going or whatever. So, I can't stop that. What I can do is look at what I can do and with myself and my life, my finances, and help those around me. In that context, I'm not a geopolitical expert. I'm not a military expert. You know, is there a way this escalation stops without dragging the U.S. in and turning it into World War III? I don't know. I don't think anybody wants that. So I'm not betting on it. What I do know is that things have not looked this scary for quite some time. And in that world, there is demand for safe haven assets. So yeah, it's not surprising to see gold up on a day like today as you and I record. And, you know, that's significant. So can I tell you what's going to happen? No. Can I tell you that I sleep better knowing that I have bullion physically, you know, in my control, third palm tree on the left on the beach, you know, the midnight gardening? Yes. And I think that's important. I think days like today remind us for why, you know, they call us gold bugs or tinfoil hat or whatever. But on days like today, it's a good reminder that there's nothing tinfoil hatty or crazy about taking out a bit of insurance or a lot of insurance.
Yeah, very well said. I couldn't have said it better. So thank you. Speaking of which, this really relates to the gold move. As I mentioned off camera, I'm an avid follower of yours on X, and you made this before all of this started happening over in the Middle East. I don't want to say before it started happening today, you made a tweet about how you were joking, but not really, how you're a little concerned because this gold move is so strong and everybody's starting to talk about gold. Let's visit that. And it is a strong move, but do you see this move long in the tooth, or where are you at with that?
No, and two ways of looking at this. So the no is no, I don't see it as long in the tooth. I mean, for, you know, a bona fide market wave or cycle, you know, do you get the despondency, you know, ignoring and hope, and then you're going up into the mania phase and then denial, right? All the way back down again. That well-known cycle we all know and love to hate. We're nowhere near mania phase. And, you know, people like to say, oh, we have echoes of the 70s, trouble in the Middle East, restrictions on oil supply, inflation, looks like stagflation, and so on. You know, I remember the 70s. I may not look old enough, but I do. And no, I wasn't on Wall Street managing the 70s then, but as a kid making money, I wasn't a shoeshine boy, but I babysat and I mowed lawns. I did all kinds of things. And I remember that context. And I remember putting my money into silver dollars because there was no blockchain to give me fractional gold ownership at the time. And I remember, so I wasn't the shoeshine boy, but I was the lawnmower boy. And I was talking about gold and silver with anybody who would listen, right? You know, that sort of thing where you went into the bar and the bartender would show you the shiny new gold coin he got or something. That's completely absent this time around. We haven't gone anywhere near that level of participation. And I don't think we did and get anywhere near in 2011 either. So does it have to repeat? Do we have to see the same thing? No. But if you're going to say, oh, well, this is a mania, this is a, you know, contrarians should be nervous to the point, you know, like we get nervous when everybody starts getting on board. If you're a contrarian, it's way too soon to say, oh, that's it. CNBC mentioned gold, I'm selling. Like if you did that, if you sold every time one of these snarky guys on X or formerly Twitter said, oh, CNBC said something about gold, I'm selling, we would have sold at 1500. We would have sold at 1700. We would have sold at 1900, right? Like we would have sold at, you know, we wouldn't have any gold left by now. So, you know, nobody should be taking investment advice from snarky guys on Twitter alone. But the point is, I think if we're going to have anything like a mania phase, or never even my mania phase, if we're going to have any like a normal market cycle, we're nowhere near the top. As far as, you know, cycles, I'm not a chartist. I don't really look at the wave theory and so on, but, you know, I'm a fundamentalist and I look at the fundamentals and all the reasons why I said that this year I thought would be the year for gold. Like last year, my highest conviction trade was uranium. This year it's gold. And all those reasons are just now beginning to play out. You know, the I was in team hard landing. I was saying the labor market was going to crack. I was saying Fed was going to cut rates. And that was typically bullish for gold when the Fed goes into a rate cutting cycle, because gold doesn't pay interest, you know, all these things. You know, well-established trends. And those are starting to happen now, as far as I'm concerned. So that's what, remember I said there's two answers. So the one is the fundamentalist in me says, no, all the reasons why I'm bullish on gold, they're still in front of us and just now coming into play. And that's, you know, going into that from $2,600 gold is, you know, I don't even want to say where that we might go from there, because it sounds like I've got gold bug mania. But the other paw, Lobo means wolf, so I have paws rather than hands, but the other paw, though, is not just that it's gone up so much, but when you get something that's not a normal market dynamic, basically an exogenous shock like a geopolitical thing, yeah, you'll see gold go jump in response to that, usually with the dollar, which breaks this idea that they have to be opposite. You know, you'll see the safe haven demand will make people stampede into gold and the dollar at the same time. This happened last October when Hamas, you know, did the horrific thing that it did. And it happened in the second invasion of Ukraine. It happened in the first invasion of Ukraine. It happened briefly in the Gulf Wars. But the thing about that is that it's short-lived. It's not just the you know, end of the war brings the world back to normal. Some of these wars never end. It's sort of the end of the news cycle. You know, as soon as something else starts capturing the headlines beyond, gosh, it's, you know, war. Then you'll see that start to fade. And here's the thing. This isn't necessarily a bearish argument. Listen to me carefully, dear audience. I'm not saying that as soon as the war headlines cool, that gold will go down. I'm saying that in these kinds of things, we always see gold spike when there's a geopolitical event like that. And then it reverts to trend. So if the trend was upwards before, you'll get ahead of it. And then it'll come back down to meet that trend and it'll continue unless something else changes on the fundamentals. And if the trend is downwards, then it'll spike up and then it'll go lower back down. It'll meet that trend again. So we again, a clear example of this is, as I recall, is the both of the invasions of Ukraine by Russia. And the first one, the trend was down. We got a spike and then it went back down again. The second one, the trend was up. We got a spike and it came back down, but then it continued trending upwards. So in this context, it was trending upwards. We get a big spike on the war scare. Gets ahead of itself, maybe. So some correction and consolidation after one of these spikes is not just normal. I think it's almost de rigueur. I don't have the math to tell you it's 100%, but it feels like that. From my experience, it seems like every time you get a spike on some really scary geopolitical news, it will correct But then it reverts to trend. So I'm not making a bearish case. I am saying that as bullish as I am for everything else I just said, I can see space for gold to correct in the near term, as soon as the headline's cool.
Yeah, well said. I would actually really agree with you on that. And that is not, again, for everybody listening and watching, as you said, that's not a bearish case for gold. It's just, if you get a pullback here, that's entirely normal, as well, I would say, is healthy. And in fact, if we do get a pullback, hopefully the things have cooled over and de-escalated over in the Middle East. So
as a human being, yes, I would love to see that pullback be, Hezbollah and Israel and Iran and everybody, everybody takes a step back and says, look, we're too close to World War III. Let's take a breather. Yeah, I would, as a human being, I would love to see that happen. But
yeah, absolutely. Let's go back to the Fed. The Fed cut 50 basis points. I want to say this was I don't know exactly the date. It was mid-September, but I do remember it. And I was surprised. Were you quite surprised that they cut a whole 50 basis points? Was that surprising to you?
Yes and no. I was in, I try very hard not to make, specific predictions like that. Not just because I hate being wrong, which I do. It's true. I hate being wrong. But because if you tell people, oh, the Fed's going to do this, and then they don't, and people make investment decisions based on that, you probably hurt some. So I try very hard to say, here's what I think is likely and why, and different possible outcomes and so on. But the way I say yes and no is because I've been in Team Hard Landing. So if I was a mainstream economist, I would have been one of those guys saying the Fed should cut 50, the Fed should have cut in July, they should cut more. There's no way that they're not behind the curve, given what we see coming. I mean, people are admitting now that there are cracks in the labor market, that it's weakening. Mm-hmm. That they're admitting it now means that it started before. And they really started in July. The cracks started appearing in the labor market in July. And the cracks they're admitting now, it's not new cracks. This is widening of the cracks, exacerbated by the almost million jobs, this famous 818,000 jobs that just disappeared in the first revision. By the way, that's not the last revision. We'll see those numbers. The fact that this is starting to happen is becoming obvious to everybody now. If I was it's now, but at the time of the Fed was meeting, they weren't admitting any of this. They were still saying everything's fine. In fact, Powell is still saying everything is fine. So given that it hadn't become as undeniable a trend as I think it is now, I was thinking they'd probably go with 25. Because why spook the markets? And according to what they're saying, they don't need to do anything bigger. So I think that their action actually contradicted what they were saying. They were saying all along, everything's fine. We're on a nice glide path. Basically saying, we're going to stick this soft landing without saying it in so many words. And in my mind, the 50 completely contradicts that. There's no way that those two actions make sense together. I mean, we call that a jumbo cut for a reason. It's a double cut. You don't do that without some good reason. And if the excuse is, we're just normalizing, the restrictive is now down, R star, it's now down. Well, if that's true, and you're just trying to get to a normal level, non-restrictive level, well, why not go a point? The estimate is for well below where we still are. So if everything is so wonderful, we could just cut to our star or our guess of that. Why not just do it all at once? But no. So in my view, their actions speak louder than words. Their actions tell me that they saw more trouble than they're admitting. And even now, Powell at NAB yesterday saying everything's fine, everything's fine. I don't buy it. I don't believe it. I suspect that if he isn't flat out lying, then he's had too much of that Kool-Aid. And he's too programmed to see it. But I suspect that I'm not a mind reader. I don't want to make bold statements like one presidential candidate who's famous for them. I just want to say that I don't see how a fairly intelligent, well-informed human being, as Powell appears to be, could possibly not know you know, not see what is so obvious to everybody else that there is trouble out there. So, but his job isn't to tell the truth. His job is to steer the ship of state in wherever he thinks it should go. So I think that's what's going on. I think the Fed is just trying to manage expectations and confidence because that's what mainstream economics thinks they should do. I framed all this in terms of mainstream economics because, you know, if I was a mainstream economist and I believed what Powell believed, the 25 would have made sense. If I was a mainstream economist and I believe what I believe, then 50 or more would have made sense. But I'm not a mainstream economist. I actually think that they should, if the Fed has any role with rates at all, they should still be higher for longer. Yeah. I still think inflation's not dead yet. I think, you know, the recession won't necessarily create the deflation everybody's expecting, especially if Lynn Alden, I don't know if you've interviewed her and talked about fiscal dominance, but if she's right about all the other money coming from Washington, swamping out the Fed's efforts with monetary policy, then, you know, that is serious concern. You know, both parties are promising a chicken in every pot, the moon, the stars, everything else. It's highly inflationary. So for the Fed to be cutting in front of that, I think is inviting the inflation genie back out of the bottle. So I'm not a mainstream economist. If I was in Powell's shoes, I'd quit, but I'd try to pull the plug on the Fed before I did. I'd try to abolish the Fed, audit Fort Knox, all those wonderful things if I had the chance. But sorry, long-winded answer because it's kind of complicated. But the takeaways here, I think the more important point, if you remember nothing else of what I said about the Fed, is I think the 50 is a tacit admission that not all is well in Mudville. They know it, and they're trying to get less behind the curve. I don't know that they can get ahead of the curve, but they know they're behind the curve, and they're trying to get out from behind there.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you on that. That was a great answer. So thank you. I might ask, though, there's this huge implications to all of this, and it's, do you see, and again, looking into the future is very tricky, right?
Yeah.
But do you see this now that we have a massive wave or beginning a massive wave of monetary inflation, yet economic stagnant or deflation now, which is basically the worst of all worlds?
Yes. It's funny. It's funny in the sad way, in the laugh or cry kind of department. How is it, you know, mainstream economists still adhere to models in which stagflation is not possible? It literally can't happen.
Right.
And yet we know that it has. And you could say, oh, well, the 70s was different. Well, not that different. And we're not talking prehistoric times. And, you know, we've seen stagflation in Europe in, you know, very, very recent memory. So to just say, oh, that was something back in the 1970s, it's simply not true. You can look around the world, you can see examples of stagflation, and you can argue for American exceptionalism. But that point, though, is that it shouldn't even be possible, according to the models that they still use and make policy decisions on. So, pardon me, I'm getting on a bit of a rant here. What was the question?
Yeah, well, it seems like we're going to have massive monetary inflation.
Okay. So can that overcome, and can we still have the recession or stagflation? You know, right. So I don't know what will happen. Right. You know, my non-prediction attitude here. Is it possible that we get a more normal for recent decades reflationary boom? Right. Did they throw enough money at it? Which, again, remember, fiscal as well as monetary. You know, the Fed is loosening, and they almost never just loosen once. It's a cycle, right?
Right. So
Fed is loosening. There's more easy money on that side. But even if they did nothing, even if they got crazy and listened to me and hiked rates or something, right? You'd still have the other side of Washington, you know, the other end of the mall there, turning out money left and right. And remember that we've now established as, can't call it legal precedent, but let's say governance precedent, that no fault of their own is a sufficient reason to mail people not just little condolence kisses, you know, but like multi-$1,000 checks. And depending on the size of your small business, I'm not even just talking a couple thousand. Like, the STEMI checks were huge And they didn't just go to the banks and the fat cats on Wall Street. They went directly into people's pockets, which does affect consumer pricing and consumer behavior. So if we've now established that no fault of their own is sufficient and necessary, you know, to send out the money helicopters,
a recession is no fault of anybody's own.
It actually might be, depending on who they voted for. But let's set that aside for the moment. You know, obviously, it's no fault of the poor people's own. We have this vicious recession that came out of nowhere. So send out the money helicopters. In that case, sure, we could see bad news turn into good news on Wall Street. We could see, you know, skip the recession entirely. Ooh, happy days. Of course, the piper would have to be paid eventually for that party, too. The hangover cannot be put off forever. But it might not work. You could do that, and you could actually scare people enough for them to say, holy, you know, for this to be happening, you know, there must be something really bad. Now, you know, the people on the lower ends of the economic ladder, they're still going to spend that money. I'm not saying that, you know, or there will be more spending. But businesses, decisions that they're making, if they see the money helicopters fly without what seems like reasonable cause, then they could say, oh my gosh, actions speak louder than words. The government is telling us something really bad is happening. I'm not going to hire. I'm not going to expand. I'm not going to build that new factory or plant or something, right? So you could see it back. You could actually see very high inflation because of the money helicopters, but less business activity. I don't know which way it would go. Or you could see something in between. There are a lot of different pathways here, but there are a couple takeaways. One is, don't believe any pundits that tell you they know what's going to happen, because there are all these different pathways. And the other is, you know, don't conflate different ideas. Like, people often say, oh, you're in team hard landing, so, you know, that's deflationary. Well, not necessarily. Or they say, there's going to be a hard landing, so what are you going to do when the markets crash? Well, not necessarily. You know, a sudden economic shock can certainly make the markets crash. Or because the Fed has programmed investors for years now that bad news is good news, you could see markets take off on that. I mean, like, what happened in 2020 was so insane. You know, who could have predicted that before it happened? Certainly not me. You see government lockdowns. You see people ordered to stay home. And okay, they're given money to spend. But still, you know, you see the government shutting down not just a city that's in quarantine or something, but the whole fucking country.
Right.
And yet, after an initial shock, the markets go to all-time highs that very same time, not after the pandemic, not after everything opened up, during the pandemic. We got all-time highs.
Yep.
So I'm not here to rant about the craziness of all that, but I'm tempted. I'm here to say that it's not safe to assume that these different things are all of one. You know, the variables can come unglued. We are literally in uncharted waters. Any chart that you have, even from the 1970s, you know, is likely to lead you astray if you take it too literally.
Yeah, no, good answer. Speaking of which, I will rant a little. I was thinking about this just the other day, literally yesterday when I was driving down the road. I can't believe 2020 happened. The pandemic happened. Did that really happen? And I was watching people jogging on the sides of the sidewalk and all of that.
It's really incredible. It reminds us, you know, we have these, we call it the veneer of civilization, the veneer of civilization, right? It's such a thin layer. We think we're civilized, but the caveman is still there. And when some really brutal, there's some big shock. I mean, so this, for example, you might, I don't want to get too political, but the conflict in the Middle East right now, you know, you can say, well, this side is flaunting international law, that side is flaunting international law, you know, but the bottom line is, you know, when there's a massacre on either side, there's going to be a human reaction, whether it's legal, whether it's right, whether you could justify it, whether it violates anybody's rights and all this stuff. You know, as a libertarian, I have all my theories about rights and natural rights and how they work and initiation of the use of force and all that. You know, all that basically goes out the window when you get these sort of tribal moments of, you know, the brown stuff hitting the fan and there's this gut reaction. And we saw that. I mean, there was so much stuff done in 2020 that was unconstitutional and nobody blinked. almost nobody even asked questions. As for stopping it, not a chance of the snowball in the proverbial very hot place, being outside my house here in San Juan.
So, yeah. I'm not saying that right and wrong don't matter. I'm saying that in moments of historic, acute pain for a society or a civilization, bad stuff happens. And it's prudent to expect what would be human in such a case, not what's legal.
Yeah, well said. Let's talk about uranium. And the reason why I talk about uranium, when I first talked to you, this was last springtime, you made this comment, hey, we're overheating. I'm paraphrasing. It's overheated now. I would love to see a pullback. We might not get it. I'd like to see a pullback. A pullback's due. If we do, I'm going to buy more. And now here we are. We've pulled back a good part. I would say it's significantly enough. We pulled back. And now uranium's no longer in the headlines. There's your contrarian point of view. And it's boring. And boring's good. And I'm going on my own little rant. Most people, they don't buy when it's boring. Which is good, I guess. You're good for me and you. But yeah, what are your thoughts on uranium moving forward and where we're at? And what do you like?
This is why you try to be a contrarian. Momentum is a real thing in markets. Flavors of the day, people piling in because something is making headlines. That the efficient market hypothesis, if you ask me, is a load of dingo's kidneys. It might be that the harnessing through the price system of millions of minds participating in a market does discover truths in the world that a single human could never do on his or her own. But, to go from there to say that you'll never outsmart the market, I think is just wrong. Anybody that does have the courage and strength, intellectual strength, to think for themselves and resist the herd mentality, you can outsmart the market. You can outsmart millions of minds that collectively completely overpower your CPU power up here simply by being contrarian. Because you know that the mass, the herd, will occasionally stampede off a cliff or just go the wrong direction. And so the hubris here, or the arrogance, if you want to call me that, is not that I think I'm smarter than anybody else. It's that I know that the mass will make mistakes. And if I discipline myself to separate myself from the investment herd enough that I can hopefully tell the difference between, a legitimate movement, a response to value versus something that's divorced from value, overpriced or underbought. There's a profit going long as well as short. It can go either way. But the point is that markets overreact. They do get overbought. They do get oversold. That's why we have RSIs and things like that.
And we're not imagining things.
So, you don't have to have a PhD or anything to do this. It's really about discipline. One of my mottos, I have two big mottos. One is not mine, of course. It's caveat emptor, because there's so much bullshit, out there in the investment space and particularly in the mining space. Mark Twain's famous definition of a mine being a hole in the ground with a liar standing over it, right? So caveat emptor is absolutely my favorite motto. But the other one is that discipline pays. And, that's a real thing. And people want to get rich quick. And if you're looking for a get rich quick scheme, I can't help you, and beware of anybody who says they can. But if you're willing to do a little bit of work, then I think there is hope. Because the main variable here is not raw CPU power. You don't have to be Albert Einstein to do this. You just need to be disciplined enough to think independently.
Got it.
There's more to it, but there's the work too. But that's the key variable. That's the key distinguishing feature, I think, that makes the difference between successful speculators and, gamblers who are sometimes riding high and sometimes weeping into their beers.
Yeah. Got it. So that leads us back to uranium. Then you might just be fierce.
I'm really Mr. Distractions.
No.
That's uranium. Yes. Today it is a contrarian. Yes. Not quite as contrarian as it was in 22. I mean, 22 was just a gift, if you ask me. It was so hated. all I had to do was write, quote the price of spot uranium on Twitter at the time. I think it was still Twitter back then. All I had to do was mention what the broker price index was that day, and I'd get a pile of hate. Oh, you're pumping this, you're doing that. I didn't say buy. I just said he was, you know. It's not like that now. I'm not getting anywhere near that level of hate. But yeah, people are bored. Boredom is the next best thing to hate. If hate isn't going to happen, and honestly, I don't think we're going to get that much hate because the writing on the world here, on the wall here, is just too obvious. The demand side, you know, it's like every week or two, we have some announcement out of China or India or somewhere of a raft of new reactors they're building, or, you know, advanced reactors they're bringing online and things. And then the U.S. saying, oh, well, we can't be second place on that, right? Yeah. So, you know, the news on the demand side is just better and better and better. And it's so obvious. And then on top of that, now you have the climate change warriors jumping on board. Where, you know, like people who think we're all going to die in 11 years, or maybe it's 10 now, it's been a while since it was 12. But anyway, if we're all going to die in a decade or so, even nuclear power is, you know, even nuclear power might not be so bad if that can save us from all dying in 10 or 11 years. So, you know, they're getting the memo there. It's just incredibly difficult to have, I think, in that context, people just giving up and jumping out of windows or, you know, throwing hate at the word uranium. You know, and we have a new villain. Coal is more evil than uranium now in this context. So, yeah, I'm very bullish. Supply, it remains constrained. We are seeing the, you know, the low-hanging fruit, the mines on care and maintenance coming back online, and the easier, cheaper projects being built. That's happening now. And I understand there being some nervousness about that. But our estimate, our in-house estimate, is that even if all of these projects, the mothball mines and the, you know, the lower cost quartile projects, even if they all come online, is not going to be enough. And then, so I'm not worried about supply. And we're already seeing, you know, the world's largest and lowest cost producer has cut its guidance. It is producing more this year than last year, but it has cut its guidance from original intention for this year and for next year. And in fact, they're moving the goalposts. They are redefining their agreements with the governments so that they don't miss their targets, their production targets, so much in the future. This is hugely bullish in my view. So maybe not hate, but boredom is good in this. And yes, my most recent purchase was uranium. Not the metal, obviously, a stock.
Right, got it.
Okay, last question. Is there any other sector that's looking appealing to you? Obviously, again, uranium, I don't want to speak for you, but it sounds like that's your biggest, I don't want to say that's what you're most optimistic about, that and gold. But yeah, any other sector that is looks hated or boring that you like?
Okay, if we're going hated and boring, yes. I would say that right now, ahead of the recession and how that plays out with multiple pathways, I'm not interested in any industrial minerals, not even oil. You know, because it always gets whacked going into a recession. So right now, my marching orders are uranium, gold, and silver. And silver, I'm actually, people hate me for saying this, you know, it is subject to industrial demand, and we have to see how that plays out. But silver has been behaving very nicely this year. It's been mirroring gold more than copper, which had been doing last year. So I'm liking silver better near term than I had before. But I'm
wow.
More, yeah, Darth Silver. People are saying Darth killed Silver. Darth Silver, not, but I'm more comfortable with gold, right? Like gold, I have, you know, very little doubt how that plays out in the various recession, you know, soft landing, stagflation, reflation, the various scenarios in front of us. Basically, all of them look bullish for gold for me, other than near-term corrections. Silver, it depends, and you know, we'll have to see how that goes. So you know, that said, I actually see more upside in silver. Like if silver doesn't get held down, and then later when the beach ball comes punching back up through the water, I actually see more upside in silver than in gold. But near term, you know, if I have a gold stock or a silver stock and they both look just as good and I could only buy one today, I'm buying the gold stock. And the silver, let me see how the recession goes. But back to the hate question,
you know, people, especially gold bugs, love to hate electric cars. And I understand it. You know, they were shoved down our throat by the powers that be to, you know, the subsidies and mandates and all this stuff. I get it. I'm an anarchist. I don't like being pushed around any more than anybody else out there. But the fact remains that, you know, a lot of consumers, particularly the younger generations, want these products. You know, it's not just because of the mandates that they're happening. People want these cars. And they're not just going away. And so the supply destruction that we're seeing on the lithium space is significant. You've got mines going on care and maintenance. You've got expansion not happening. You've got companies looking at bankruptcy. And so, you know, lithium is not rare. I mean, it's right after hydrogen on the table of elements. But production and refining capacity was limited and the price went nuts. Markets responded, high prices were the cure for high prices, and now we have cooling global economic activity, so prices are tanking. I can see lithium coming back, even if, you know, the EV adoption rate is nothing like what the optimists want. I don't think it goes away. And even if, you know, we'll eventually have hydrogen cars or other technology in the future, I do think coming out of the recession, we're likely to see a rebound in lithium. So as far as like a hated thing, I like lithium for hate. Nickel, not so much, because in the usual time span of a recession, I think we'll see a lot more replacement of NCM batteries with LFP batteries, meaning the lithium batteries that don't have nickel, right? The iron phosphate ones were less efficient, less range, more concerned about that. But the latest generation of those have gotten much better. And there's more charging infrastructure going in. So I think there's less range anxiety than there was before. And so it's questionable to me, you know, whether the nickel batteries will come charging back after the recession. But either one has lithium. Mm-hmm. Right? So in terms of hate. The other one, you know, oil, we still have plenty of hate around the world for oil. I'm not buying it now ahead of the recession. But after the recession, absolutely. Oil, lithium, after the recession, I'm still going to want to look. You know, what's the supply and demand in the market? You know, can those mothball mines come back online quickly? I want to check it out and see how it is. Whereas oil, to me, it's just like a no-brainer. I won't have many questions. As soon as I'm sure the recession has done its worst, then I'm going to be looking to buy the best oil and gas plays I can see on the market. I would say the same of copper, but I don't see copper getting hated. So for your question for what's hated, copper doesn't work. If your question is what would I buy after I have an all clear to go on the industrial minerals and energy minerals besides uranium, mm-hmm. then the two absolute first would be oil and copper.
Yeah.
Next, I'd look at lithium, other things depend, you know, we might not have enough graphite to put in the batteries. Other things might be possible, but the oil and gas and the copper, maybe not gas, but oil and copper are the no-brainers. And then I'll be data dependent on the rest.
Got it. Good answer.
Lobo, people want to do business with you and read your stuff. Where do they go and how do they follow you?
Sure. You know, it happens to me often at conferences where somebody will come up with a spreadsheet and say, hey, this is my portfolio. What do you think? Can you tell me about this? Or I'm worried about this one. What do you think? And I cannot legally answer that question. I cannot give anybody financial advice on an individual basis. I can only publish my financial opinions via my publications. So if you've ever wanted somebody to, you know, a due diligence guy to help you like that, you know, give you a second opinion, like, you know, another doctor, look over your shoulder there. We have a service called My Take, which is like Consumer Reports, and where I do that. There's no portfolio. It's not a typical newsletter. It's a database of company valuations. And I'm saying this, it's a paid product. I'm saying this because people just don't understand. People often, you know, they subscribe and they're like, oh my God, I had no idea. There's almost 1,000 companies that you can slice it and dice it, make lists of, you know, buying lists or selling lists, you know, all this sort of stuff. So that's one answer. If you want to hire me to be your due diligence guy, I can't do it one-on-one, but I can help through My Take. Before that, just there's a free newsletter called The Speculator's Digest. It's a weekly letter. You may or may not like the way I think and work, but that'll show you my mind. And the one thing I can promise about that is that if you sign up, we will not spam you with a flood of daily advertisements. I hate that. You get one email per week. decide whether or not, you know, I might have the right stuff to be your due diligence guy.
Excellent. Lovell, I want to thank you so much. It's been great getting to know you over the past year. I've always been a fan of your work. And yeah, it's great being getting to know you and seeing you not only in Zoom, but in person. So thank you for that. And all the best. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Andy. Until next time.
Yep, absolutely.